What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we'll take a look at the big stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, the U.S. turns its back on climate change. What does this mean for the Pacific? And what happens when a narco sub washes ashore? We take a look at how these drug smuggling vessels have a new lease of life in the Pacific. And we take a look at the history of an invasive species of weed that's destroying Vanuatu's forests. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, they're stealthy, semi-submersible, and can sneak narcotics across oceans in bulk. And recently, suspected narco subs are showing up in the Pacific. In the past 12 months, three empty vessels have been found floating near the Solomons. And over the past few months, two were discovered on a small atoll in Marshall Islands. So what happens when a narco sub washes up to your front door? Well, the ABC's Lucy Cooper found out.
Arkman Laukowan had heard about a boat running aground on one of the isolated islands in his home of the Marshall Islands, but seeing it with his own eyes stunned him.
I was kind of shocked. I was surprised. It's my first time to see this kind of boat. Firsthand, like right there in front of me.
He was on Anu Atoll helping locals with the installation of satellite internet when he saw the boat on the beach.
It's like those boats we saw on TV, on news. It's got a four outboard engine on it, but the body, the hull is kind of fully covered. It's like a semi-sub, but still have the outboard engine at the back. So I would suspect it's a narco boat.
Once unheard of, the appearance of narco subs in the Pacific is no longer a novelty. In the past 12 months, three have been discovered in Solomon Islands. Mr. Laukowan says the one he saw on Anu Atoll is the second to be found in the area.
So far, I've seen two. The one I saw recently and the another one is on the other part of the island.
Experts say the increasing presence of narco subs could indicate cartels are expanding their trafficking in the Pacific to make up for the loss of income in other business ventures. They're ocean-going, semi-submersible and often custom-built by drug cartels to transfer huge amounts of product. The subs have been used in the Americas for decades, but the newer vessels are often fully submersible in order to reduce detection by radar or sonar. The latest sub in the Marshall Islands was discovered by fisherman Weston Killamer, who was alerted by his neighbours.
My other neighbours on the island saw the boat drifting through the reefs and they contacted me. When I went to the beach, the boat was already on the reef. My main objective at that moment was to try and save the boat and tow it to the lagoon so I could anchor it.
Mr. Killamer's home is on the beach where the boat ran aground.
I claimed ownership of the boat because it ended up on my property. So it's common practice here on the islands that if anything washes up on your property line, it's automatically yours.
He contacted authorities about the narco sub, but doesn't know if they ever inspected it, so is now claiming it as his own.
Nobody else is going to come and touch it until they ask for my permission.
When a narco sub was discovered in Solomon Islands by a local doctor, he decided to turn the 25-metre-long vessel into his personal boat. And so, as narco subs become increasingly common in the Pacific, it seems their new life and purpose is up to whoever claims it.
Right now, I don't have any plans for the boat. I'm just trying to figure out what to do given the huge outboard engines. I don't really know how to repair them, and I need to find someone to do it for me. And that was Watson Killamer, a fisherman in the Marshall Islands, ending that story from Lucy Cooper. Tuvalu's climate change minister says it's hard to engage Australia on a moral level over climate change. Australia is set to co-host the pre-meeting for this year's UN Climate Conference with Pacific Nations. But Dr. Maina Talia says that's an unfair position while Australia continues expanding its coal and gas projects. Dr. Talia is currently in Australia and he spoke with the ABC's Jordan Fennell.
In trying to call the country Australia for support and especially to do away with the opening of coal mines. Unfortunately, you know, I understand that this is the backbone for the economy of Australia, but they are transitioning away from opening new coal mines. But it's so unfortunate because it's the opening of new coal mines does not only limits to a 5-year project, but it requires a lot of years to come.
And would you say that Tuvalu doesn't have that time to wait?
We are running out of time. Anything to do with climate change and sea level rise, we're dealing with time, and we cannot just pick up the pace that, you know, the negative effect of climate change on our land and our people. It's just too fast. I was born and raised in Tuvalu and still in Tuvalu, and I would definitely not live in Tuvalu. So it's difficult to understand the rate, the level of the sea is climbing too fast. But only if we have the resources to respond systematically to what we're going through, then I think it's fair enough. But at the moment, we don't have that resources. That's why we continue to rely on industrialized countries that have the resources and the technology to ensure that we can respond systematically to what is going on, what is happening to our people and our land.
What's your message for Australia while you're here in the country now?
I think the message is very simple. If we continue to burn fossil fuel, if we continue to open new coal mines, and definitely, on the other hand, we are letting go of our moral responsibility. We're letting go of countries like mine to go underwater. And it's very unfair if we continue to open coal mines and do the opposite, especially when we're co-hosting the Australia-Pacific pre-COP, the upcoming one. So I think we have to show some moral clarity, show some moral leadership in terms of bringing the Conference of the Party closer to home.
And that was Tuvalu's climate change minister, Dr. Maina Talia, speaking there to the ABC's Jordan Fennell. In the eyes of US President Donald Trump, the idea that climate change is a threat to public health is a scam. So the president has killed off a key scientific finding that's at the root of US climate laws. Known as the endangerment finding, it has underpinned limits on greenhouse gas emissions. But now, as Lucy Cooper reports, those regulations are being dismantled, much to the dismay of climate activists in the Pacific.
It's a move that's angered Pacific climate campaigners.
This is just the latest in a concerning trend from the current US administration that is trying to save an industry at the cost of human health and lives.
We're tired of receiving bad news, really, on climate. And the US, unfortunately, we're seeing that constantly, very frequently, under the current administration.
When US President Donald Trump walked into a press conference in the White House last week and told reporters, "This is a big one if you're into environment," he wasn't kidding.
We are officially terminating the so-called endangerment finding, a disastrous Obama-era policy that severely damaged the American auto industry and massively drove up prices for American consumers.
In the space of a few minutes, with the belief that climate change is a con job, the president announced to the world that his administration was revoking the basis for nearly all climate laws in the US. Known as the endangerment finding, it was issued by the Environmental Protection Agency in 2009. It led to the determination that greenhouse gases warmed the earth and endangered the health and welfare of current and future generations. It's since served as the legal basis for federal climate regulations, setting limits on greenhouse gas emissions. Here's Christian Downey, professor in the School of Regulation and Global Governance at the Australian National University.
I don't think there's a president in US history that's really presented, you know, such a threat to global efforts to cut pollution as Trump has. But I think legal challenges will come thick and fast. We'll see environmental groups, we'll see Democratic-controlled states like California mount legal cases to challenge this repeal.
If litigation fails and the US doesn't cut pollution, Mr. Downey said, as the second largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, international climate goals are going to be further out of reach. For Jacinta Fa'amau, a campaigner for environmental organisation 350 Pacific, the announcement is a blow to Pacific communities.
For us in the Pacific, who contribute only around 0.02% of global carbon emissions, you know, Pacific countries, you know, have been carrying the weight of global climate leadership. You know, while the Trump administration can manipulate their, you know, scientific agencies, it can never suppress the truth that ordinary people in the Pacific, in the US and around the world are paying the real price for big oil profits and other fossil fuels. Lives are being lost, homes are being destroyed and costs are soaring.
The announcement has coincided with the news that the US is urging countries to pressure Vanuatu to withdraw a UN draft resolution supporting a landmark International Court of Justice ruling that countries have a legal obligation to act on climate change. The campaign, which sparked the finding, was initiated by the group Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change. Vishal Prasad is its director.
It's very unfortunate and really a dangerous step taken by the US government at a time when the world needs to be ramping up climate action.
He said he was disappointed the US had decided to repeal the endangerment finding.
It is something that really puts the world, puts the US, the world, and particularly small island developing states in a lot of trouble, because we now have to win in our fight for climate justice. This does not help us. And so it really is unfortunate and very disappointing that the US has decided to do this counter to the science and the law.
Like Jacinta Fa'amau, Mr. Prasad holds out hope.
This is not just an issue for the Pacific. This is an issue for the whole world, and parts of the US are already seeing some of the very severe impacts of climate change. Communities are already witnessing this. So we think it's just a matter of time before the US realizes that it needs to act on climate change, and we're hoping that sooner rather than later.
And that was Vishal Prasad, Director of Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change, ending that report from Lucy Cooper. It's a big week for science in the Pacific region, with the inaugural Congress of the Pacific Academy of Sciences. The Academy was created to elevate and champion Pacific researchers. The three-day Congress in Apia brings them together with policymakers and Indigenous knowledge holders to shape regional and global agendas. The ABC Samoa reporter Adele Fruin went along and filed this report.
It's a big moment for the newly formed Pacific Academy of Science. Established in 2024, the Academy is holding its first Congress, bringing together researchers, Indigenous knowledge holders, and emerging scholars across the Pacific under the theme, Harnessing the Knowledge of the Pacific. Samoa's Minister of Education and Culture, Aiono Dr. Alika Kiroma, opened the Congress on Monday by championing Indigenous voices and calling for Pacific science to shape global conversations.
I am deeply passionate about elevating Pacific voices in science. I believe that regional challenges require regional solutions. Research and innovation hold the key to unlocking our potential. From exploring the skies above us to deepening our understanding of our oceans and lands, science and humanities are lifelines, helping us build resilient societies and improve the quality of life for all our people.
The minister says too often Pacific voices are not represented enough in the global stage. These sentiments were also shared by the Academy's executive director, the Imanaya Dr. Ronnie Nokshu.
People are still a bit unsure about who we are and what we do. And we are also very clear that we don't teach science, but that what we are doing is trying to provide a platform where we can get Pacific scientists to sit on the global stage and represent us. No one knows what it's like to live in the region better than we do, and often science is written about us without us.
She says the Academy also has a focus on championing emerging scientists through its Young Academy.
So the Young Academy sits side by side with our Pacific Academy of Sciences, and this is a platform for early to mid-career researchers. Now, what that looks like and what it'll do actually is going to be co-designed as part of this Congress. So we've purposely invited a few up-and-coming young researchers, and on Wednesday we'll have a workshop in which it provides sort of a direction of how we want to use this platform. But the Young Academy is there in order to provide an additional stepping stone to what we do with our Pacific Academy of Sciences.
The Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Guam, Dr. Kenneth Cooper, recently joined the Academy with high hopes of learning and collaborating in finding solutions for the issues facing the Pacific.
Sure. So when I first saw the, you know, call for applications, I immediately knew I wanted to join because this was one of the first times that the Pacific was coming together as a, you know, as a body to really advance scientific knowledge, and most importantly, to center Pacific Island knowledge along with science, because our knowledges have always been science, right? And to have it formalized in this way and be a part of that is incredibly humbling, and I'm very grateful for this opportunity.
And that was the ABC's reporter in Samoa, Adele Fruin, reporting. A fisheries expert says the arrest of crews from three foreign fishing vessels in Papua New Guinea exposes a much bigger illegal fishing problem in the country. 24 crew members from Indonesian boats were fined $150,000 and could face decades in jail if they failed to pay. Prime Minister James Marape has used the arrests to repeat a warning that illegal foreign fishing vessels caught in PNG waters will be sunk. But Professor Ralph Mana from the University of Papua New Guinea says large parts of the country's fishing waters remain unmonitored, making enforcement difficult.
To be honest, it's a huge problem. You know, we don't have surveillance boats. You know, the Australians gave us probably one or two of those patrol boats, but they're the Northern Sea, Manus and over there to look at the, you know, tuna, illegal fishing of tuna fish. But on the southern side, like from Western Province all the way from there to Gulf of Papua, there is no surveillance there. And illegal fishing is a common thing on the southern region, Western Province, all the way up to Gulf of Papua, because these are highly, very lucrative for fishing ground. You know, we got prawn fishery and we got all kinds of fisheries there. And most of those illegal boats are coming from the other side, be it Indonesia or could be Vietnamese or any other boats, but they enter from the Torres Strait. Because as I've said, there's no surveillance over there. I mean, people over there actually see those boats illegally coming to their waters, steal those fish right in front of them. And what can they do? And then they return back to the Indonesian waters. It's very sad indeed.
Do you think this measure that the Prime Minister is warning about, sinking of these illegal ships, if they're caught, do you think that would help improve things?
This is not the first time that the boats were being caught. And I think the Prime Minister is just following what happened. I mean, that's the best thing we could do. There's nothing else. I mean, if they want to find those fishermen and their company or resell those boats, that's another issue there. But what I could remember is same incident happened before, and that's what had happened. Mm.
From your experience, is there anything that the government can do in response to this problem of illegal fishing?
If we can have some surveillance center at Bula area, around Bula, Torasi Estuary, the Betsberg River that comes out, that's exactly where the border is. So if we can have some sort of a surveillance outpost by NFA, and by the way, NFA got a lot of money, you know, $500 million from tuna every year. And I don't know what they're doing with that money. So if they can just put an outpost there with some speed boats, that will really reduce those illegal fishing entering PNG waters from the western side.
In terms of NFA, what powers do they have in terms of this? Are they the ones that go out and seize these boats and capture?
This is under their jurisdiction, right? I mean, the Defense Force, naval boats, okay, they during the ISIS and all that, they also play a major role in that. But when it comes to fisheries, NFA should be taking a role in this actively. And they're not doing it. It's very sad.
Do you think there's also room for improved partnerships with countries like Australia next door in terms of surveillance and intercepting these vessels?
Australia have their own similar problems, but they have their facilities, and they more or less control these activities, yes, on their side. Now, if you look at this Torres Strait, there's a very narrow area between Australia and PNG. And those boats coming in there, we can apprehend them right there before they actually come all the way to Gulf of Papua. And it's not a big deal, as I've said. Put a patrol post right there, Bula, for instance, and have some boats there 24/7. You will reduce those illegal fishing 90% or more. It's very simple.
And that was Professor Ralph Mana from the University of Papua New Guinea. Across the forest of Vanuatu, an invasive species has taken over, destroying habitats for birds, insects, and animals. With origins unknown and nearly impossible to kill, managing big leaf, as it's called, is a major challenge. But one tiny village is changing that and at the same time earning an income, as the ABC's Lucy Cooper reports.
Skip Sir loves his home, Kole Village, in the east of Vanuatu's Santo Island.
The thing that I love most in the forest is the wet environment there.
But it's under threat. A woody, tropical vine is suffocating forests.
Really destroys many trees and also destroys the forest.
Commonly known as big leaf, it's got big leaves and ropey vines, which locals say forms a kind of blanket that smothers the forest. Its origins are murky and up for debate. Some say it was brought in during World War II. Others say it could be native. According to local lore, the woody vine was brought to the island to camouflage Allied operations. It's the origin story Chief Skip's father had also believed.
It's an interesting one because, in fact, there are two weeds. There's big leaf and there's also mile a minute. They're very different looking. However, they're both extremely fast-growing tropical vines. And big leaf is considered to be the biggest driver of deforestation in Vanuatu because it literally strangles the existing vegetation and invades the forests. It's unbelievably destructive.
That's James Carter, the project manager at the South Pacific World War II Museum in Luganville.
It's believed that one of them was brought to Vanuatu during the war by the Americans to camouflage their ground structures, which makes a lot of sense. But then it depends on your research sources as to which one that was, because there is no proof that the Americans brought either of them to Vanuatu. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence.
Vanuatu's northern island, Santo, was home to the biggest American supply base in the South Pacific in World War II.
We have got photos in our collection from the war where you can see both species growing in different areas. But the problem we have with the photos is all the ones we've got were taken in either 1944 or 1945. So if the Americans brought it with them in 1942, well then, yes, it would have spread and it would be growing everywhere.
Mr. Carter said the theory it was brought in during World War II is accepted across Vanuatu.
I remember when we went looking for a Royal New Zealand Air Force Corsair a few years back, and we got to the spot where the local guy said, it's here. And we're going, where? We can't see anything. They said, hang on. And they got out with their bush knives and they cut their way through all the big leaf, dragged it all off, and there was the aircraft. So it was completely covered by the big leaf. It's extremely invasive, unbelievably invasive, and you can see how it's just killing everything.
Big leaf is spelling big problems for the forests of Vanuatu, but back in Kole Village, it's starting to clear. It's all thanks to a project Chief Skip and his clan have started. They cut down big leaf and in its place are planting native fruit trees from their own nursery.
We are not careful, then we'll lose everything, every resource inside our land. So we decided to conserve this forest to protect our resources and to conserve our resources so that the future generation will see maybe the birds, the trees.
It builds on his father's legacy, who established the Lawroo Conservation Area across 220 hectares. Glorinda Andre is a director at Live and Learn Vanuatu, a non-government organisation. Whilst the income is important for the community, for Chief Skip, it's all about providing for the next generation.
Climate change is what is happening now. It's very hot, we have sea level rise and other things, pollution. And I think very important to stop this climate change. Maybe we have to look after the trees.
And there was Chief Skip Sir of Kole Village in Vanuatu Santo Island, ending that report from Lucy Cooper. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company. And join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.